The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Nice to see you here. My name is Andrew Irvin. I have a great joy tonight. And I personally can't wait for these readings, so I'm going to do this quickly. I'll start with Richard Powers. He's the author of 12 novels, each more lovely and profound and transcendent than the previous. Among many other well-deserved prizes, he's won a MacArthur Fellowship, a Lannan Literary Award, and the 2006 National Book Award for The Echo Maker. His most recent novel, The Overstory, is certain to add to that list. Writing in the New York Times this week, Barbara Kingsolver called it a gigantic fable of genuine truths held together by connective tissue of tender exchange between fictional friends, lovers, parents, and children. That's all true, but more than that, it's also a love story to the natural world, and in particular to the trees that allow us to share this planet with them. It may very well be Powers' greatest achievement yet. Then again, every reader I know has a different favorite Richard Powers novel, and I take that as a great sign. William T. Volman here, backstage, is a writer and thinker of seemingly endless talent. He's the author of 23 books to date, which include fiction, poetry, photography, nonfiction, and firsthand reportage on a mind-boggling range of topics. In 2005, his stunning novel Europe Central won the National Book Award, and his long-running Seven Dreams series about the European occupation of the New World already stands among the monumental literary projects of our age. His new book, Carbon Ideologies, is a nonfiction accounting of the ongoing destruction of our planet. It spread across two heart-stopping and indeed heartbreaking volumes. I'm always wary when someone tells me that a book is required reading, and yet this book is required reading. Both authors here tonight have cited Philadelphia's great naturalist, Lauren Isley, at different times, and a quote of his came to mind while reading their new books. "We are one of many appearances of this thing called life," Isley wrote. "And we are not its perfect image, for it has no image except life, and life is multitudinous and emergent in the stream of time. As we will hear, The Overstory and Carbon Ideologies both celebrate that very same life. Please join me in welcoming Richard Powers and welcoming William T. Volman to the stage. Thank you.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming. It's great to be back in Philadelphia. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. I would like to begin by citing my colleague here, Mr. Powers. How is extraction ever going to stop? It can't even slow down. The only thing we know how to do is grow. Grow harder, grow faster. More than last year. Growth. All the way up to the cliff and over. No other possibility. And now I'd like to read to you a little bit from the first volume of Carbon Ideologies about careless growth. This is set in one of the so-called yellow zones of Fukushima, so not the true red zones, whose radiation levels were much higher. A couple things I should mention. The isotope of concern in that area is cesium-137, whose half-life is a little over 30 years. It takes 10 half-lives to get down to 1,000th of the high value. So you're looking at 300 years plus. A microsievert is a unit of biological damage. One micro an hour is considered dangerous. My studio in SAC is about 0.06 micros, and a millisievert is 1,000 micros. That's why I'm going first, because all these numbers are quite dull, and then you'll get to hear the interesting part after I'm out of it. This part is called the Harvest Festival. "No, I'm not worried about any thieves," answered Mr. Endo Kazuhiro, "since my home is not gorgeous. I wish the thieves would clean it up. I was born there. I'm the fourth generation, more than 100 years, almost 200. The house is not gorgeous, just old. The roof is traditional farmer's thatch." "In what district is it?" "To the west, along the Kawauchi Road. It looks all right from the outside," he laughed. "I was there last year in summer. I went only to visit my ancestors' tombs." "When was that?" "On the 1st of August. I think it was about 4 microsieverts per hour, it must have been, although if he had mostly stayed in a vehicle, that could also have been his total accrued dose. In company with everyone else, he was unsure of the measurement units. Thus, one of the reasons that Iwaki people threw up their hands and shut out harmful rumors. I would have done the same." "What did you most enjoy about your childhood in Tomioka?" "I lived close to the mountains, and in my childhood I seldom came to the sea. The landscape was prettier then than now. In the past, there were almost no roads like this, as we sped by a row of black bags of radioactive waste on an Iwaki beach. The kids played hide-and-seek and kicked the can. We waded in the river. There were wild boars and foxes, also raccoons, although we didn't see them so often. Now most of the humans are gone, so the animals might be more rampant." "You don't think they die from radiation?" "I don't think so." "So they're stronger in that way than humans?" He laughed. "I don't know. There are some abandoned pets." He always liked to drive alongside the ocean, as far north as he could go. He did not recommend the swimming nowadays. In between black bags, the shorescape appeared lovely and even harmless. I asked him to tell me more about his life. He said, "In my 20s, I went to Tokyo for 10 years. I learned a lot of bad things, like drinking." He laughed again. "In Tokyo, I was a truck driver. After I came back here, I was employed by a waste disposal company from my 30s, collecting garbage, sewage, and so on. The nuclear power plant had been built even before I was 20. Based on your experience in the field, is decontamination effective?" "Not at all. It's the most wasteful, useless activity." "Who's making the money?" "General contractors from Tokyo City and this prefecture. If we all work together and voice our opposition strongly, we might be effective. But as it is, we're too weak." On this first spring-like day, when suddenly birds were singing, I would have rolled down the window to breathe fresh air. But Mr. Endo liked the heat on, and anyway, the breeze seemed to be blowing directly south from nuclear plant number 1. Halfway to Tomioka, the dosimeter had already accrued an extra microsievert. This made me pull it out of my shirt pocket more frequently, but after that, it remained at 0.287 accrued millisieverts. I inquired regarding relations with the Iwaki people, and he said, "The area around our temporary housing has good households, and the local elders take good care of us. In that area, they're nice to us." Then I asked, just to see what he would say, whether he considered Iwaki people selfish, and he readily changed his tone. "It's just rumor, but I heard that one former Tomioka resident purchased land in Iwaki and built a house. Then he went to greet the neighbors, as is our custom, but they said, 'No, we cannot be friends with you because you are from Tomioka.' I hear the city of Iwaki has accepted from the central government 40 or 50,000 yen per refugee. So it's not right that Iwaki people be so mean." According to his information, the temporary housing was supposed to close in about 5 years. "After 5 more years of radioactive decay," I asked, "will Tomioka be safe?" "Regardless of natural decay, I believe it will take 20 years. For an instant, He fell silent, as if he might be contemplating those 20 years. As you and I now know, 20 years would fall short of even one cesium half-life. But decontamination and rainfall might work wonders. Then he said, elderly people will die naturally before radiation cancer affects them, so they wouldn't mind returning. I myself wouldn't return. I don't know whether my children will come back. His eldest child was already 33. Regrettably, none of them are married yet, so I have no grandchild, he laughed. How is your wife managing nowadays? So-so. At least she's not sick. Do you know anyone who has come down with radiation sickness? I believe that some of the workers at the number one site are sick, but this information won't be leaked. The families will be paid off to keep it secret. What do you miss most about Tomioka? There was a shrine at the mountain, and we always held a torch festival there. This event I cannot experience again, he said in his gravelly voice, steering one-handed now to gesture at the air. And I used to fish in the river. We played in the mountains in our generation. Then he remarked, when we were told to evacuate, everyone thought we would come back in a few days, so we didn't take many things. When your friends and neighbors return to Tomioka, how long do they feel safe staying here? 6 hours, and only during the daytime. You're not allowed to stay at night. There's electricity, but no water, so you can't stay. How do you feel about TEPCO? When we were young, when the TEPCO plant was built, we were very thankful to finally be able to work locally. In this area, when you say, I got a good job, that means I'm a TEPCO employee or a civil servant. As we reached the border of Tomioka Township, that familiar tingling metallic taste came into my mouth, surely psychosomatic. The snow had almost all melted as we came down the hill, slowed by a crush of construction vehicles. Now we had already passed nuclear plant number 2. What do you think about nuclear power these days? At this stage, I'm against it, because the response to the accident has been so poor. If the government cares to restart any of these nuclear plants, they'd better do a much better job. When we rolled into Tomioka, the dosimeter was still at 0.287 millisieverts, and I expected it to accrue digits rapidly, but in fact, it registered only one additional microsievert during our 2 hours there, the most non-radioactive visit I ever had to that place, at least so far as gamma rays were concerned. If I claimed otherwise, I would be spreading harmful rumors. The fact that the breeze now blew from the northwest must have borne on our pleasant situation, and it might have been advantageous that we soon turned off Highway 6, which a man at the Department of Nuclear Countermeasures had checked for me just the other day with his scintillation meter, 3.72 microsieverts per hour, doubtless the result of all those decontamination trucks grinding in and out of that main checkpoint. When we were still south of the pachinko parlor, Mr. Endo swung east, and much more quickly than I had expected, we came in sight of the sea, which, to be sure, still lay some distance away across the tsunami-leveled plain of grassy foundations. We parked at Tomioka Station, and I asked to stroll about for a moment. A television crew happened to be there. Its members wore paper face masks, which might at least have kept the alpha and beta particles out. As for us, we amused ourselves with the old joke that there was no immediate danger. So we looked across the ruined railroad tracks at the forgotten foundations and high grass. We gazed at the blue-green sea. I'll bet there are deformed fish over there, he said with a grim laugh. Now he wished to go. Begging his indulgence for another moment, I walked up the earthquake-damaged stairs, following the helpful arrows in the direction of the former Iwaki line. Fortunately, the stairs did not give way, so I crossed the high enclosed bridge over the tracks, stepping on broken glass and hole panes, all of which lay fairly dustless. I stood looking at the sea. It would have been pleasant to wander through the tall grass and come to the shore, but the vegetation measurements I had taken the other day made me more cautious, perhaps because the freshening breeze now changed direction and blew dust in my face. So instead, I returned across the bridge to the near side of the station, where cables dangled down like fingers over the platform, and I breathed in that cool sea breeze, no matter how poisonous it might have been. which plutonium isotope had escaped from plant number 3 in 2011? Was its half-life 253 minutes, 88 years, or 24 millennia? The latter, warned a Japanese muckraker, for number 3 was a pluthermal reactor designed to produce plutonium-239. When I returned home, Ed Lyman from the Union of Concerned Scientists consoled me. According to measurement, the plutonium seems to be a relatively small fraction of the radiological hazard. But he added that all measurements of this disaster's nuclear contaminants remained incomplete. Well, well, in any case, we must admit that this famous pluthermal reactor proved itself a true credit to the industry. Now, more than any other time during this return to Fukushima, I was reminded of how the coast of Tohoku had looked 3 years ago, just after the earthquake and tsunami. For here by the seashore remained wreckage and the broken open ugliness of things, cars slammed into crazy positions. But even in this place, I felt a slight sense of mellowness, since the tidal wave's mucky filth was gone and the grass had begun to soften the dead streetscapes into something forlorn and shabby rather than outright raw. In some of this weed-grown decrepitude, there had even begun to shine, at least in my eyes, those classical Japanese rusty beauties called wabi and sabi. But of course, they must have been poisoned. I expressed my pleasure at the excellent radiation reading, and Mr. Endo remarked, "They say it's pretty low over there." "See that one?" he said, smiling as if it were a joke. "That building had just been built." We stood on the still street with the brown weeds growing up between wrecked cars and daylight shining through a hole in the back of an apartment building. Then we re-entered his car and began rolling up west again, with the high grass thickening as we went. I glimpsed yellow tape over an especially ruined house, a patch of snow beneath a shaded house, down through this sad weediness and up again, the visible damage rapidly lessening now that we were out of the tsunami's reach. When I remarked on this, Mr. Endo said, "These houses may look good on the outside, but once the roof tiles are gone, the rain comes in." A single policeman stood at a checkpoint at the narrow street. The light had already begun lowering, and as we ascended westward, there were more patches of snow in the brown grass. "Here in the beginning, along the river, there were a lot of loose cattle," he said. "They had to be killed because they entered houses." Rolling past what appeared to be a vast vacant lot in front of some decrepit and vaguely official edifice, he said, "There's the elementary school from which I graduated. At that time, the building was still wooden." There was never any self-pity in anything he said. He was such a strong and cheerful man, so Japanese in his bright, brave patience. Here came a ruined neighborhood, two black bags by the roadside, and then we turned down a boulevard of leafless cherry trees whose tops reached toward each other across the road. Mr. Endo said, "When they're in bloom, it's so beautiful, like a cherry blossom tunnel. But now they're not maintained." "There's my house," he said, pointing through the snow. "But it's overgrown now, not really presentable." I said I would very much like to see it. So he turned in past a lovely, dirty mound of snow, carefully driving over slushy ice on a narrow, uncleared road, the car swaying and laboring. I wondered whether we would get stuck. Then, over the snow-covered road, a bird flew up as the brassy female recorded voice roared about protective gear. "That's our garden," he said, "but the bamboo grew. It's a forest. 3 years ago, there wasn't any." Walking through soft snow, pushing our way through waist-high weeds, I wondered how contaminated these surfaces might be. One block away, the red zone began. Soon I would stroll up to that barricade, but at that time I lacked my scintillation counter, so what could I perceive there but harmful rumors? There loomed a dead freeway or underpass out of which an unpleasant breeze blew into my face. I preferred the windless thicket around Mr. Endo's house. Meanwhile, the dosimeter remained at 0.287, but that meant nothing. Even at 72 times Iwaki's radiation level, it might not turn over for another quarter hour. So we entered the bamboo grove, which had grown up around three parked vehicles and was pretty enough in its way, and presently reached the house. Mr. Endo led the way around two fallen lockers. Once upon a time, they had secured his tools. Removing a spacer from the track of the glass door, he slid it open. There'd been no reason to lock it. Rat droppings, speckled shoes, boots, a fan, a vacuum cleaner, shelves and chairs, which were all tipped and tilted by the earthquake into a waist-high jumble within the dankness of his former home. He did not invite me in, and anyway, I saw no point in further trawling through that melancholy disorder, so I took a photograph or two, then he closed the door. Brown wisteria had grown up over the house. The robot girl was roaring and echoing. What did you take when you evacuated? I got my bank book and family seal and my parents' portrait. When was your wife's last visit here? She came just once to visit the tombs of our ancestors. Otherwise, she prefers not to see this. There he stood, with his cap tilted upward on his forehead, staring at the wisteria whose creepers aimed at him, bullwhips frozen in mid-crackle, reflecting themselves in the front window, hanging off the roof. I wondered whether he felt any impulse to fight them. He showed us the family persimmon tree, remarking, "It was here when I was born." There in the fallen leaves beneath the bamboo lay his daughter's abandoned car, along with two other vehicles which he had used for storage back in the day. The doors were unlocked, of course. He thought for a moment, then took out the young woman's fishing rod from the back seat, remarking, as if this feature had once pleased him, "It extends for 10 meters. We wandered around his archaeological site. I could tell that he wished to be gone, and I felt guilty to have dragged him here, but I also thought that coming here with him was the right thing for my sake and yours. He was now 62. When he was 60, the accident had occurred. He said, "I wanted to be a subsistence rice farmer in my retirement. Right here by the road, this was my field. The other one was my neighbor's. Elsewhere, I had two other rice fields. One of them was near a pond. Well, that was my dream. Will you ever live here again? This house is contaminated with radioactivity. Once the waste site for the location has been established, we will demolish the house. Owners are compensated in proportion to tsunami and earthquake damage. My house is less than half collapsed, so I must take care of the demolition myself. It would have been better if it had collapsed. I wish you could have been with me in that tall brown grass with those head-high weeds all around and his house half vanished under the bamboo. There we stood in the cool wind and the snow, and that home of his so shabby and forgotten, with the wisteria crawling up the roof and the bamboo already three times as high as the house. Soon the wisteria will crush it," he said, almost smiling. "It's more dangerous than the bamboo." Across the snow-drifted street from his house was a modern brick building where his neighbors once dwelled, a husband and wife with three children. They live in Iwaki. Sometimes we see each other and drink together. I remarked that their house looked pretty good. He said, "Inside, it's as messy as mine." Then we began to drive away, with the car sliding and almost sticking in the snow. I felt a quiet horror, but hordes of crows were cawing over the fields. What if my 10 half-lives calculation were faulty? Weren't Kawauchi and Hirono partially open to return, with Naraha gaining some daytime use? According to that intrepid nuclear experimenter, the U.S. Army, after the first 48 hours, the extent of radioactivity will be reduced 100-fold, enabling you to leave the bomb shelter. At the end of 2 weeks, the radiation level will decrease 1,000 times. If this were true, as I wished it to be, then the Iwaki people would be correct in their calmness. "The issue," remarked Ed Lyman, "is how uniform are the hot spots?" He believed that the levels were dropping more rapidly in urban areas whose non-absorbent surfaces caused the cesium to wash away into the water table, most likely, while forests and open meadows retained their higher counts. It seemed only right to him, and I agree, that every returning resident be given a good dosimeter and that anyone who did not wish to accept a 1,000th concentration of poisons over prior background levels be compensated and permitted to leave. Mr. Endo, meanwhile, asserted, "The government says they are trying to force the people to return. If I were him, I would stay away." By this time, poor Mr. Endo would really have liked to get away. But I asked if we could please stop by the shrine he had mentioned. So he kindly drove there. It was not far. The road was empty, of course, and the dosimeter remained steady. The characters on the gate read, "Hayama Shrine." Leaving the car, we walked toward a wide hill of trees. Given what Ed Lyman said about radiation declines in porous versus non-porous surfaces, not to mention the nuclear countermeasures man's measurements of a certain bamboo grove, I would imagine that this lovely, shady place was dosing us nicely with beta rays. And how much of a dose had we accrued in our early weed meanderings? Fortunately, I prefer to think of radiation as a sort of vitamin. That way I won't spread harmful rumors. "Whom is this shrine to?" "I don't know," he said. "We just go there to the festival to pray for a good harvest. Young men climb to the top of the mountain, and then if you see the flame at the top of the mountain from your house, the harvest will be good. We used to circle this shrine building and then use the path to circle the mountain. At the beginning we'd run," he laughed, "but then I'd get tired. It takes 45 minutes or an hour. When we get close to the top, we start running again." Only men carried the torch. Mr. Endo had done so every year from age 16 to 40. One of the two stone guardian dogs had fallen, and not far from his cracked corpse rose the wide stone steps across which a heavy branch had lately fallen. A great block of joined stones had also toppled, partially smashing the concrete wall upon which it lay, half sunken in the earth behind. At the top of the stairs, I saw weeds at the edge of the shrine porch, darkness under the eaves. We stood looking down from the torus at a plain of black bags of nuclear waste. Then we looked at the forested hill above the shrine, the place of dead leaves and lovely tall pines. "It's hard to get up there," he laughed. In his harsh nasal voice, he told me a little about bygone festivals, and like the old grandmother in abandoned Kawauchi, he appeared to grow very happy, smiling as if with real pleasure. "When I was a child, there was some closed place up there, and I was mischievous, so I opened it, and lots of bees came out and stung me." I smiled back at him. "In the summer, there's lots of rehearsing," he said. "I can hear the drumming from my house, the drumming and the flute. Then I feel that I'm coming into festival season." I asked whether anyone celebrated here nowadays. "Last year I tried to get the young guys to practice with the drum and flute, but it didn't happen in time, so we played a CD. Up here, at the temporary housing, serve some drinks." Again, we were looking down from the chilly, shadowed shrine. There was much snow and a single bird. He said there were thrushes, sparrows, doves, and pheasants hereabouts. He used to hunt pheasants with a certain friend, but the heart for that went out of him after his friend died. We descended to the car and began to drive away across that plain of black bags and brown grass with crows flying up everywhere. "Both my parents were from here," he said. We turned onto the empty toll highway, 15 kilometers to Hirono. As a victim of the accident, he could drive it for free, lucky fellow. The sky was already performing its spurious brightening into evening light. Soon we would be on the safe side of that still unbuilt wall of ice, where people lived their lives as best they could, while past and future tragedies resembled those tsunami-murdered homes whose foundations were now only slightly more distinct than the boundaries of rice fields. Mr. Endo drove silently. When I thanked him for his trouble, he assured me that it was all right, since no one else had been willing to go, and besides, he didn't really feel anything. I sat in the back seat, so I could not directly see his face. His reflection looked really sad in the mirror. Thank you.
It's a special pleasure for me to read here tonight. First of all, to be introduced by my most distinguished former student from University of Illinois, Andrew Irvin. And second of all, to be reading with William Volman, who's been on my radar since his first novel, You Bright and Risen Angels, 30-some years ago, and who has cast a very strong influence on me, both in his fiction and his nonfiction. I think it was a mutual friend of ours, David Foster Wallace, who invented a school, a movement, and he included Bill and myself and Franzen and Wallace. And these were united by the common aesthetic of being white males all around the same age, over 6 feet tall. So it's nice to have a first formal presentation of this school. For the last 5 years, I've been telling people that I've been working on a novel about trees, and this is always met by a kind of polite bemusement. This is the first time that I've read from the book or presented it in public, and I'm still wrapping my head around how to convert that 500-page novel into a soundbite. I guess it has to be something like this. 9 very different people learn in very different ways that it might be necessary to reconsider the effects on their lives and on the human race of enormous, long-lived creatures of incredible versatility and ingenuity that alter the atmosphere, create the soil, filter the earth's water. And the book really is a meditation on how we would not be us without trees, and to try to find a way of bringing into the human story something that is almost invisible to almost all of us. I'd like to read with special thanks tonight for the work and the person of Joan Malouf, who's here. Joan is one of our great writers on trees. She's written a number of books that were invaluable to me as I was researching this novel. She is also the founder and director of the Old Growth Forest Network. So if you're interested in finding out how you can experience what America looked like before we came, Joan is a good person to talk to. You can look up the Old Growth Forest Network on her web, or you can talk to her after the event. The only thing I need to do to set this scene is to say that it's based roughly on the Pacific Lumber story, for any of you who know this, but the basic outline of the dramatic confrontation here is similar to a real-life event in which a junk bond king manages to buy up a family business that had been cutting trees sustainably for a long period of time, decides to use the ancient coastal redwoods themselves to pay off the debt incurred in buying the company and pass the bill along to the American taxpayers in the form of insolvencies of one kind or another. But there really are only 2 characters in this scene. It'll sound as if there are 4, because the 2 characters, Nicholas Houle, who's a kind of a art school flame out, who has been conscripted by Olivia Vandergraff, who has recently, a college student of actuarial science, who has recently had a near-death experience, and they find themselves at this point trying to confront this company with the help of other forest activists in Northern California by climbing up the redwoods and tree-sitting to prevent the cutting of these 1,000-year-old creatures. Nicholas has taken the forest name Watchman, and Olivia has taken the forest name Maidenhair. So it sounds like a bridge game, but it's just a cribbage game. They slog the last few hundred yards up the rut, Maidenhair, Watchman, and their guide Loki, who has run ground support for this tree for weeks. A profile emerges out of the thicket, so huge it can't be right. There it is, Loki says. There's Mimas. Sounds come up and out of Nick's mouth, syllables that mean loosely, "Oh, my hopeless Jesus." He has seen monster trees for weeks, but never one like this. Mimas, wider across than his great-great-grandfather's old farmhouse. It runs straight up like a chimney butte and neglects to stop. 25 feet above ground, a secondary trunk springs out of the expanse of a flank, a branch as big as any eastern tree. Two more trunks flare out higher up the main shaft. Watchman humps up to where Maidenhair stands gazing. Even in the falling light, her face glows with cause. All the agitation has drained away, replaced by a certainty as pure and painful as an owl's call. Her face tilts up the titanic trunk. "I can't believe there's no other way to protect this thing except with our bodies." Loki says, "If nobody's losing money or getting hurt, the law doesn't give a fuck." The base of the tree between two enormous burls opens onto a goose pen large enough to sleep all three of them tonight. Soot marks run up the trunk, the scars of fires that burned before there was an America. And from high up in the tangled mass, vanishingly far above ground, come the cheers of two exhausted people out of their element who just want to be dry and warm and safe again tonight for a few hours. Something tumbles down from above. A rope dangles in the air, the width of Watchman's index finger, in front of a shaft wider than his field of view. "What do we do with this? Attach the packs?" Loki chuckles. "You climb it." He produces a harness, loops of knotted rope and carabiners. He starts to put the belt around Watchman's waist. "Hang on. Are these staples?" "There's been some wear. Don't worry. The staples and duct tape won't bear your weight." "No, this little shoestring will bear my weight." Olivia steps between the bickering men and pulls the harness around her own waist. Loki clamps her in with carabiners. He cables her to the climbing rope with two sliding prussic knots, one for her chest and the other for a foot stirrup. "Stand up on the stirrup, push the chestnut as high as you can, lean back, let it take your weight. Sit back into the harness, slip the stirrup knot up as high as it'll go, then stand up on that and repeat." Maidenhair laughs, "Like an inchworm." She stands up, she leans back and sits, she stands and inches again, climbing a ladder of air, hoisting herself in self-raising footholds off the face of the earth. Watchman stands underneath as she scoots into the sky. The intimacy, her body writhing above him, makes his whole soul flush. "She's a natural," Loki says. "She'll reach the top in 20 minutes. She does, although every muscle in her is shaking by arrival. From above, cheers greet her summit. Down at ground level, jealousy seizes Nick, and when the harness drops again, he springs into it. He gets about 100 feet into the air before freaking. The rope can't possibly hold him. It's twisting and making weird nylon groaning sounds. He cranes his neck to see how much farther. Forever. Then he makes the mistake of looking down. Loki twirls in slow circles below. Nick's muscles surrender to panic. He closes his eyes and whispers, "I can't do this. I'm dead." He feels the zoom, the endless drop coursing through his legs. Two small lumps of vomit come up his throat and onto his windbreaker. But Olivia is talking, up close into his ear. "Nick, you've done this already. I've seen it for weeks." "One hand," she says. "One foot. Sit. Slide the knot stand. He opens his eyes on the trunk of Mimas, the largest, strongest, widest, oldest, surest, sanest living thing he has ever seen. Keeper of 500,000 days and nights, and it wants him in its crown. Shouts greet him at the top. Those above him fasten him with clamps into the tree. Olivia scampers about the platforms along a rope ladder. Buzzard and Sparks have long since talked her through every clause in the lease. They want only to be gone before night traps them. They climb down the rope to Loki, who calls up through the encroaching dark. Someone will be by with your replacement in a few days. All you need to do until then is stay aloft. Then Nick is alone with this woman who has commandeered his life. She takes his hand, which still has not unkinked from gripping. Nick, we're here, in Mimas. She speaks the creature's name like she's been talking with it for a long time. They sit next to each other in needle-grazed darkness, 200 feet in the air, on what Buzzard and Sparks called the Grand Ballroom, a 7-by-9-foot platform made of three doors bolted together. Sliding tarp walls shelter them on three sides. Bigger than my room at college, Olivia says. Lots nicer. Balanced on another branch just beneath is a small piece of plywood. A rain barrel, collecting jar, and sealable bucket complete the bathroom. 6 feet above them on a higher spur, another platform serves as pantry, kitchen, and den. It's filled with water, food, tarps, and supplies. A hammock stretches between two limbs and cradles a substantial lending library left there by previous sitters. The whole three-level treehouse balances on the top of an enormous fork made when the trunk was hit by lightning centuries ago. It sways with every breeze. A kerosene lamp illuminates her face. He has never seen her look so confirmed. Come here. She takes his wrist and guides him to her. Here, closer. As if farther away were an option. And she takes him, like someone who's sure that life needs her. In the night, something warm grazes his face. Her hand, he thinks, or the fall of her hair as she leans over him. Even the slow, seasick barcarolle of the sleeping bag bed feels blessed. The cramped quarters of love. A claw cuts into his cheek and the succubus lets loose with falsetto gibbers. Watchman bolts up, screaming, "Shit!" He pitches toward the platform ledge, stopped by his safety cable. One palm punches through the fantasy of tarp walls. Lives go shrieking off into the branches. She's up in a flash, pinning his arms. Nick, stop, Nick, it's okay. In the hail of chatter, he's slow to hear what she keeps saying. Flying squirrels, they've been playing all over us for 10 minutes. Christ, why? She laughs and pulls him back down horizontal. You'll just have to ask them if they ever come back. She nuzzles him, her belly in the small of his back. Sleep won't come. There are creatures that live so high up and far away from man that they never learned fear. And thanks to the humanity in his cells, Nick has this very first night of his very first tree sit taught them. Light gathers in speckled fistfuls on his face. He has slept almost not at all, but rises refreshed in a way normally reserved for the industrious. He rolls onto his side and lifts the tarp. The whole spectrum streams in, from blues to browns, greens to absurd golds. Look at that. Let's see. Her Loki voice breathes in his ear. Oh, goodness. They look together. High-wire surveyors of a newfound land. Cloud, mountain, world tree, and mist. All the tangled, rich stability of creation leaves him stupid with silence. Reiterated trunks grow out of Mimas's main line, shooting up parallel like the fingers of a Buddha's upraised hand. Recouping the mother tree on smaller scales, repeating the inborn shape again and again, their branches running into each other, too mazy and fused to trace. Fog coats the canopy. Through an opening in Mimas's crown, the tufted spires of nearby trunks stand swirled in a phantasmagoric Ordovician fairy tale. It's morning, like the morning when life first came up on dry land. Nick sweeps back another wall of tarp along its rope runner. Dozens more feet of Mimas unfold above, trunks that took over when lightning clipped this one. The top of the tangled system disappears into low cloud, fungi and lichen everywhere, like splatters of paint from a heavenly can. He and Maidenhair perch most of the way up the flat iron building. Below, the floor of the forest is a dollscape a little girl might make out of acorns and ferns. His legs go cold with thoughts of plummeting. He lowers the tarp. She's staring at him, madness in her hazel eyes that spills out as cackling. We're here. We made it. This is where they want us. Here and there, solo spires rise above the giant's chorus. They look like green thunderheads or rocket plumes. Only now, 70 yards above the ground, can Nicholas gauge the true size of these few old ones, 5 times larger than the largest whale. In the middle distance, the forest broadens into denser, deeper blue. On every side, trees lap at the low, wet sky, the clouds they themselves have helped to seed. Skeins of aerial needles sip the fog banks, condensing water vapor and sieving it down the sluices of twigs and branches. The land unfolds, ridge beyond ridge. His eyes adjust to the baroque abundance. Forests of 5 different shades bathe in the midst, each one a biome to creatures still to be discovered. And every tree he looks on belongs to a Texas financier who has never seen a redwood, but means to gut them all to pay off the debt he took on to acquire them. A shift in the warmth next to him reminds Watchman he's not the only large vertebrate in this roost. If I don't quit looking, my bladder's going to burst. Olivia scrambles down the rope ladder to the platform below. He thinks, I really should look away. But he's living in a tree 200 feet above the surface of the planet. Flying squirrels have surveilled his face. Fogs from the world's infancy turn the clock back eons, and he feels himself becoming another species. She squats above the wide-mouthed jar, and a stream rushes out of her. He has never seen a woman urinate, something a fair number of human males who've ever lived will have to say on their deathbeds. The ritual concealment suddenly seems like some strange animal behavior that might turn up on a BBC wildlife documentary, like fish that change sex when they need to, or spiders that consume their partners after mating. He hears that revered, received pronunciation whispering off camera. When removed from their kind, individual human beings can change in remarkable ways. When she's done, she tips the jar over the side of the platform. The wind takes the liquid and disperses it. 20 feet and her waist atomizes into the fog. Needles will rework it into something alive again. My turn, he says, when she comes back. And then, from above, she watches him crouch into the bag-lined bucket, which will go to Loki for removal and compost when he shows up next. They take breakfast al fresco. Their chill fingers feed hazelnuts and dried apricots into mouths that hang open, awed by the view. Sitting still and looking, their new job description. But they're humans, and soon enough, she says, let's explore. The main trails from the grand ballroom are laid out with loops and lobster claws, rope ladders, places to hook a carabine or two. She gives him the harness. Then she makes one for herself from three nylon climbing cables. He wobbles out onto a waving branch. The wind blows, and Mimas's entire crown dips and bucks. He'll die. Plunge 20 stories onto a bed of ferns. But he's getting used to the idea. And there are worse ways to go. They head off in different directions. He inches along one barrel-sized limb, cabled in, scooting on his pants seat. The scraped branch smells of lemons. One twig holds a shock of cones, each smaller than a marble. He takes one and taps it on his open palm. Seeds fall out like coarsely ground pepper, stuck in the crease of his lifeline. From such a speck came a tree that holds him 200 feet in the air without flexing. This fortress tower that could sleep a village and still have room to let. From high above, she calls, "Huckleberries, a whole patch up here." Bugs swarm, iridescent, party-colored, minuscule horror film monsters. He works his way to a strange junction. Two large beams over the course of centuries have flowed together like modeling clay. He grapples to the top of the hillock and finds it hollow. Inside is a small lake. Plants grow along a pond flecked with tiny crustaceans. Something moves in the shadows, speckled all over in chestnut, bronze, black, and yellow. Seconds pass before Nick coughs up a name. Salamander. How did a damp-seeking creature with inch-long limbs climb two-thirds of the length of a football field up the side of fibrous bark? The only plausible explanation is that its ancestors got on board 1,000 years ago and rode the elevator up for 500 generations. Nick edges himself back the way he came. He's propped up in the corner of the grand ballroom when Maidenhair returns. She's ditched the safety umbilical. You'll never believe what I found. A 6-foot hemlock growing in a mat of soil this deep. Jesus, Olivia, were you free climbing? Don't worry. I climbed a lot of trees when I was little. She kisses him, a quick, preemptive strike. And you know, Mimas says he won't let us fall. He sketches her as she copies her morning discoveries into a spiral notebook. The drill of solitude comes so much easier for him than it does for her. After years of camping in an Iowa farmhouse, a day at the top of this Leviathan flagpole is like stepping out. She, though, in her core chemistry, is still a college girl, addicted to a rate of stimulations per second that she hasn't entirely kicked. The fog burns off. Deep in the expanse of midday, she asks, "What time would you say it is?" Her question is more mystified than agitated. The sun hasn't passed overhead, and yet the two of them are worlds older than what they were this time yesterday. He looks up from sketching the local labyrinth of Mimas's limbs and shrugs. She giggles. "Okay, what day?" Soon enough, an afternoon, half an hour, a minute, all feel the same size. Just crossing the 9-foot platform is a national epic. More time passes, 1/10 of an eternity, 2/10. Then she speaks again. The softness shatters him. "I never knew how strong a drug other people were. The strongest, or at least the most widely abused. How long does it take to detox?" He considers. Nobody's ever clean. In the hammock library, she finds a book, The Secret Forest. "Would you like me to read to you?" She reads like she's in the front of an assembled class, reciting that long freight train of stanzas from Leaves of Grass that the entire 10th grade was assigned to memorize. You and the tree in your backyard come from a common ancestor. She stops and looks out the transparent wall of their treehouse. 1.5 billion years ago, the two of you parted ways. She pauses again, as if to do the math. But even now, after an immense journey in separate directions, that tree and you still share 1/4 of your genes. Tacking into the breeze of the author's thought, they make their way through 4 full pages before the light starts to fall. They eat again by candlelight, instant soup mix floating on 2 cups of water warmed on the tiny camp stove. By the time they're done, darkness rules, filled with the 1,000 spectral challenges of night that they cannot decode. "We should save the candle," she says. It's hours before bedtime. They lie on the long rocking platform of their pledge, chattering to each other in the dark. Up here they face no dangers but the oldest one. When the wind blows, it feels like they're crossing the Pacific on a makeshift raft. When the wind stops, the stillness suspends them between 2 eternities in the caress of here and now. In the dark, she asks, "What are you thinking?" He's thinking that his life has reached its zenith this very day, that he has lived to see everything he wants, lived to see himself happy. "I was thinking it's going to be cold again tonight. We may need to zip the bags together." "I'm down with that." Every star in the galaxy rolls out above them through the blue-black needles in a river of spilled milk. The night sky, the best drug there was before people came together to make something stronger. They zip the bags together. "You know," she says, "if one of us falls, the other's going with. I'll follow you anywhere." They wake before the light to the sound of chainsaws in the deep beneath them. Thank you.
For Mr. Powers, I was just wondering, halfway through this project, the Hidden Life of Trees came out, and I was wondering...
More than halfway, actually. I think I was in the last year of it when that book came out.
Okay. Yeah. So I was just wondering, like, how you felt, if you felt that you'd been scooped, or if he had primed the pump for the success of your book.
Oh, my goodness, no. It's hard to describe what happened to me while writing this book. I got to a point where I thought every novel being published should be about trees. You know, I just and you know, the Volleben was a great. You know, I just thought the more people read, the more people know about how astonishing the behaviors, not just of individual trees, but of the society that is a forest, the more people will be able to read a book like this. By the time I was reading the Volleben, I mean, much of what he writes about, people like Joan have been writing about for years. And you know, he did a wonderful job compiling, and it was fabulous. I mean, even for people who have been laboring in the wilderness for a long time, you know, and you know, the it's a rich pantheon of names. I think everyone was delighted that a book of this sort was finally presented in a way that could break through to mainstream audiences and bring them into the deeper and richer bibliography that has existed for a while and will continue to be added to in the years ahead.
This is a question for William. I'm just curious, the amount of detail that you pack into everything is pretty dizzying. So can you just explain how your kind of like reporting process, are you remembering everything? Are you filming everything? Are you audio recording everything? And then a side question would be, I just wonder what's in that backpack.
I have The Galley of the Overstory by my friend and colleague, and two volumes of Carbon Ideologies, and some banana bread from Drew's wife. And
your back has not been thrown out yet, right?
That's right, yeah. And the pancake frisker, just in case anyone wants to play radiation monitor sometime. When I was in the exclusion zones, I had a camera and a notebook, and I wrote constantly. Sometimes when I was with a person such as Mr. Endo, all I had time to do was write down what he was saying and take some very quick notes. But when I looked at my negatives later, I could see, for instance, you know, the expression on his face when he was looking at the wisteria coming over his roof and seeming to be arrowing toward him. So that's what I did there.
I'll jump in here. We were talking briefly backstage about deforestation as sort of a theme of both books, and at least Carbon Ideologies in its in the entire project. And I wonder if you could both tee off on that a bit.
The first, what would you say, about a third of volume one of Carbon Ideologies actually sets the stage and is a kind of primer in the nature of the crisis. And I would say so,
but of course, you know far more about trees than I do.
Right. As I was reading the first part of volume one of Carbon Ideologies, I was getting that familiar sense of, we are so beyond hosed. How do we even keep our spirits enough to think clearly about the problem, let alone confront it? And, you know, I do like Gramsci's, you know, formulation, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, but it's tough, and it's tough in the face of the kinds of statistics that Bill is putting forward. I want to say this though: if you're looking for something to rally you, to marshal whatever sense of will or possibility that you might be looking for, I recently came across a project called Drawdowns. Anyone familiar with this?
That's a neat book.
Yeah. So this was one of the great environmental books of last year. But if you Google the word drawdown, you'll go to their website. And what they've done, this is a series of lots of people working in lots of different disciplines, putting forward the 80 most salient and probably most powerful counters to the carbon buildup. What can we do to offset what we're putting into the atmosphere? And here's the common denominator. This is a long prelude to saying that of those 80, easily 20% have to do with trees. And many of the top, you know, the ones that would have the most impact on the environment have to do with not just reforestation, afforestation, but with wiser ways of using agricultural land that have to do with intercropping, permaculture, and using trees in a way that can get us off the crazy agricultural dependencies that we're on right now. And I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah, if I could just add one thing. It's a very discouraging thing to learn that if we stopped all of our carbon dioxide emissions today, the Earth would continue to warm and the seas would continue to rise for at least 2,000 years, and maybe 7 or 8,000. The only real hope we have of reversing that process is to tie up some of that carbon and draw it out of the atmosphere. And that is something that our plant friends can do. A 100-pound bale of hay has 40 pounds of carbon in it. And I'm sure you probably know much better about the variation in trees. But
I think Joan probably knows a lot more than I do. But
well, yeah. A tree such as Mimas probably had quite a bit of carbon in it before it was pulped.
And you know, here's another thing about old growth. You know, the refrain is always, they grow back. What difference does it make? Well, as Joan opened my eyes to, we have not in our lifetime, in any human being's lifetime, ever seen the return of old growth. But one optimistic discovery of recent years is that old trees actually continue to sequester carbon at tremendous rates. It used to be an argument, probably on the part of those people who wanted to take them down and use them for other things, that somehow a tree stopped after a while sequestering carbon, which is kind of a nutty thing, but you know, that people believed that for a long time, and now it's quite clear that the sequestration in an old-growth forest is not only extremely high, but the rate it also continues to go up as trees age.
Just for everyone's information, according to the Japanese greenhouse reports, lumber and paper and wood chips and so on and so forth, once they are put into a landfill, will give off most or all of their carbon within about 30 years.
So you see, getting hit from two different directions. Not only are those creatures no longer helping you remove the carbon, but they're actually giving it back up after they're cut.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll have to continue the conversation upstairs. Please join me in thanking Rick Powers and Bill Goldman.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.